Our yoga instructor challenged us to find inner peace. I found it faster than anyone. After 4 seconds, I stood up and screamed, "I found nirvana! I win!" They asked me to leave. I guess they don't respect winning. Bet365 does, though. New customers get $365 in bonus bets just for betting $10. Namaste, losers. Bet365. Winning is everything. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-MY-RESET. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Football on off the ball.
You know, when you get to work in a place for like 4 or 5 days a week, 6 days a week, all your life, I know every sort of, you know, like things like the tiles, where there's a little crack in the tile somewhere going up the stairs and the changing room walls and everything. I know it all to the end of my life.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Keith Tracy is with us in studio. Good morning, Keith.
Morning, everybody. How are we?
And Dara Smith-Naughton is with us as well. Dara, how are you?
Hey, lads. Good morning. How are things?
So, big weekend of sport. I'll run through what's happening this weekend.
Do you have a schedule there, yeah?
I do have a schedule. People, yeah. So, for everybody who is looking to watch some sport this weekend, we've got the final round of the URC, starting with Connacht tonight against Edinburgh and Ulster against Glasgow. We've got the PGA Championship Day 2. 21-year-old Aldrich Poldgeter has the lead after round one. Although an ominous Scottie Scheffler is tied with him, so he's coming. He's coming. Shane Lowry is tied for 8th, though.
Yeah.
Just 2 shots off the lead. Rory McIlroy had a horrendous back 9 to finish 4 over, and Padraig Carrington is on a similar boat to him. Then Aston Villa are taking on Liverpool this evening in the Premier League, which that will have a big impact on the Champions League places as well, with Bournemouth looming large as well. Plus, we have a full slate of League of Ireland games. Dundalk against Shamrock Rovers is going to be tasty enough tonight. Keith, you're going to that game. We also have commentary with Ben Symes and Vinnie Perth at that game. That's going to be a big one.
Yeah, should be an absolute cracker. I'm looking forward to seeing Dundalk live again. I've seen them, I think, 2 or 3 times so far this season, but every time I watch Kieran Kilduff and the likes of Daryl Horgan and Keith Buckley and young Owen Kenny, every time I look at Owen Kenny, he gets more and more impressive. So really looking forward to seeing Dundalk up against Shamrock Rovers. We know Rovers are very, very good, but you feel somebody needs to put a bit of dint in them, you know. Before we get into Europe, if Shamrock Rovers have a buffer or are already top of the league, I think we're all a little bit fearful that he could run away with it. But Dundalk have been excellent, and I don't think they'd be fearful of anybody.
Saturday's a massive game, or a massive day for sport in general. We've got kick-off the day with Celtic against Hearts to decide the Scottish League title. That's at 12:30. We'll talk about the VAR decision in that very, very shortly, because in the back papers again, Hearts are putting the pressure on the Scottish FA to make sure that the referees do not decide this league title. So, a bit of mind games from Derek McInnes and the Hearts team there. A crucial Munster hurling tie between Clare and Tipperary in Sample Stadium. A game which will likely have a huge impact on whether the All-Ireland title winners last year or 2024's All-Ireland title winners miss out on the All-Ireland series. So that's a massive game. Kilkenny are in the mires as well in the Leinster. They're coming up against Kildare in a must-win game after their game last weekend. Then we have the FA Cup final, Man City taking on Chelsea. Potentially the last time we see Pep Guardiola lead Manchester City out in an FA Cup fixture.
In Wembley, yeah.
Yeah, and then to top it all off, we've got Ireland against Grenada in Murcia at 5 o'clock. So Saturday's a big one.
What's the, between the two is, what's the priority? What are we watching this weekend? Because we're going to have to be, you're going to have to be very disciplined.
Well, we have to hear Sundays first as well.
We've got
another day. There's 3 full days of sport this weekend. So Sunday we have 2 provincial finals. We've got Leinster and we've got Ulster. Dublin against Westmeath, they're kicking off the weekend at 2 p.m. and that's followed by Monaghan against Armagh in the Ulster final at 4:10. I think that game is actually kicking off in Clonus. We've got a full slate of Premier League games as well. We've got the Saturday slate of Premier League games on Sunday because of the FA Cup final. And Ireland are taking on Scotland in the Women's Six Nations on Sunday. That is the end of the the Women's Six Nations as well. Yep. So Ireland looking to finish third on the Six Nations table. And of course, then we have the conclusion of the PGA Championship. So
yeah.
Do you think you're getting many steps in this weekend?
I wouldn't have thought so. I'd be glued to the FA Cup final, obviously, looking at Chelsea and Manchester City. I'm always interested what Chelsea team are going to turn up. Obviously, being an Arsenal fan, I'd be looking at City and I'd be hoping for extra time, penalties, a really violent affair. I can't imagine it will be anything like that. It'll be total football, but as long as City get taken into extra time and the legs start to go like jelly, I know they've got, you know, a huge squad and the midweek game probably won't even be on their minds just yet. But yeah, as long as City get a couple of bumps and bruises along the way, I'll be happy enough.
Mm. I think for me, it's Celtic against Hearts is the is the game for the weekend. Obviously, a little bit biased, as the YouTube viewers found out last night or yesterday morning.
You were outed as a Celtic fan.
I was outed as a Celtic fan. It didn't go well.
You outed yourself as a Celtic fan, I would say.
Yeah, that's a big one for me. But also the Sunday provincials as well is going to be huge. Obviously, Westmeath, they're massive underdogs going up against Dublin, but you never know.
They're massive underdogs in the eyes of the bookies. But in the eyes of everyone else, I wouldn't say they're massive underdogs. They're obviously not favourites. But coming off the games that they've had as of late, Dublin, I suppose that Loud game has probably put fans and pundits at ease when it comes to Dublin and how they're playing. But I really, really wouldn't write off Westmeath. It feels like there's something coming in the Midlands there.
The momentum of riding the wave could get them over. And you never know. I was actually watching the Maroon documentary. I don't know if you've seen this, Keith, but 2004, Westmeath won their first Leinster title in, I think it was 50-odd years. And it was Paddy O'Shea had come up from Kerry. He was sacked by Kerry, or he left, his contract wasn't renewed by Kerry. And the next day he signed up as Westmeath boss. And Westmeath were in the mires. They were nowhere near it, had a terrible league campaign. And then they just went on this run and they won. They won the Leinster title, but they had a documentary crew filming in the background the entire time.
Back in 2004?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Really, it's really like Last Dance type of thing, you know?
Very much
so. It's called The Maroon documentary.
It's called Marooned.
Right, I'll have to have a look at that.
So the play on words there was kind of, it was basically built around Paddy O'Shea and how he was marooned in Westmeath, having come up from Kerry. And he had a really tough time in Kerry at the end of his career because he was managing them, and he had come out with this line comparing Kerry fans to animals. But what he meant, and he explained it in the documentary, is that he meant they were animals in the sense of they always wanted to win. They were competitive animals. Yeah. Is sort of how he meant it. But it didn't come across
that
way.
Like that. No, you can imagine it.
So he was replaced, and it really hurt him hard. And he even says it in the documentary, like he was still really hurt by this decision.
Yeah.
And he went to Westmeath, and he just completely turned this team around. And look, they had very talented players as well. That's the thing that probably gets lost in all of this, is that he didn't take a group of nobodies to this fantastic achievement. These players went on to have fantastic careers, like John Cain, who's joining us today. He went on to win an All-Star, and Alan Mangan scored one of the winning points in the Leinster. And, you know, you had a young Desi Dolan playing for them as well.
It's not like Coach Carter.
Exactly,
this was a half-decent team.
Half-decent team, probably at the early stages of their development, and he was an All-Ireland winner that made them believe, is essentially the story behind this. So that's sort of what we're going to be talking about.
Lovely. See what you're saying about the bookies there, that you wouldn't write Westmeath off. Have you ever gone to a bookies and the price put you off? Because I've gone and I think Liverpool will win today, and you go and they're 3-1 on or 3-1 against, and you can, they know something I don't hear. And I've backed off just because of odds, and thought the bookies, they're generally not too far wrong.
Backed off like your own intuition.
I would have an notion, and now I see the prices and think, oh no.
Yeah, it does make you question yourself. You're like, why do they have it 7-1? I thought this game was much closer. And that's the thing, like they could be right, and I think history would suggest that they would be right. Dublin tend to get the beating of Westmeath, particularly in Croke Park, but I just feel like this Westmeath team is far more talented than people have given credit for. Like, it's a weird thing that I've watched a lot of Westmeath over the last couple of seasons as a Cavan man, because there's so many different parallels there, but obviously in the same division as them in the last few seasons, not this season obviously, but like Dermot McCabe was the Westmeath manager last season, is now the Cavan manager, he's a Cavan man, and they've been incredibly unlucky in a lot of fixtures. Like, they've been a good team, you know, Matthew talks about it a good bit as well, like they have good players, they have good footballers, they just had this thing over the last two seasons where they just haven't been able to close out games, and had they had that, they'd probably be a decent Division 2 team this season and be where they're at now. But, you know, Mark McHugh's come in and he's just instilled a bit of belief in them and just, you know, made them believe, like Paddy O'Shea did, that, you know, you guys are some, you have some talent here, you just need to put it all together, and that's what they've done the last couple of games against Meath and Kildare. Dublin's obviously a step up from that, but at the same time, like, Meath were being talked about as not quite All-Ireland contenders, but right up there in terms of talent, and, you know, Jordan Morris is one of the best players in the country on his day, there's no doubt about that, and they just dismantled them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that shouldn't be taken lightly whatsoever. This isn't just a good story. I think this is actually a good team that has a real chance of competing in Leinster over the next few seasons.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they approach the game as well. If they defend really heavily, or if they actually go for it. Jim Gavin was actually speaking about this yesterday on the show, and he said that the teams that went at them and went man to man and took them on caused them the most issues.
Yeah.
So you never know. Look, Dublin aren't what they were. The unfortunate thing for Westmeath is Dublin also have something to prove. So
yeah,
that's the thing that they're going to come up against. We'll run through some of the papers really quickly. On the back of the eye paper, we've got Rory Litt's bogeys get up his nose. Rory McIlroy obviously had a really, really difficult time in Philly yesterday in the first round of the PGA Championship. That is on the back of the Times as well. We've got bogey, 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 bogey for Rory. And we've also got playoff final delay threat over Spygate. We'll talk about that in just one second. It looks like the Championship playoff might actually be delayed as a result of the Middlesbrough-Southampton Spygate scenario. The hearing is actually today, but it looks like there's going to be actual legal proceedings taken as well, which is going to push back the game. On the back of the Sun, we have take it as read. Arnie Slot thinks he has every reason to carry on next season. And Carrick, people open talks over full-time role. Looks like Michael Carrick is getting the job at Manchester United. We also have at the top of this, Katie Gunner be departing. So it broke last night that Katie McCabe is going to be departing Arsenal after joining them from Shelburne 2015. She has made over 300 appearances for Arsenal, won the Women's Champions League last year, won the Women's Super League in 2019. She plays her last game for Arsenal. They go away to Liverpool this weekend. She actually had a home game against Everton last week, and they didn't make this announcement. Seems a bit odd considering the rumours were there that Katie McCabe was going to be departing Arsenal. Some rumours that she might be joining Manchester City, which would be a massive move for her at this stage of her career. But disappointing in many ways for Katie that she didn't get the send-off that she definitely deserves at Arsenal, because she is a club legend. She has been transformative for Arsenal and for women's football in Ireland in the modern era.
Yeah. Exactly. I would be very, very surprised. I know it hasn't unfolded that, you know, she's come out in front of the Emirates and thousands of fans have waved her off. I know that hasn't quite unfolded just yet, but I would be really, really surprised if, you know, on the training ground, in the changing room, that they haven't made Katie feel, you know, like the legend that she is at Arsenal. 11 years at that club, as you say, won almost everything there. And it looks like she's going to move on to Manchester City, which is, as you say, will be a brilliant, brilliant move. But she's a great leader, brilliant, brilliant player. Probably one of Ireland's women's best ever players now. She's already up in that sort of company. So we wish her the best. Is she 31 now, Katie? Or maybe 30?
She's 30. Yeah.
30, so she's got a little bit more to go if she's looked after herself. But, you know, what can you say about Katie that already hasn't been said? She's an absolute legend and a trailblazer for women's football, and always pays heed to the Irish women that came before her, the likes of Olivia O'Toole, who somebody that I would know quite well. So yeah, I've all the respect in the world for Katie, and I hope, even though I'm an Arsenal fan, I hope it's a Manchester City move for her, because, yeah, I'd love to see her there. I think it's a match made in heaven if she did put that blue jersey on.
it can't be understated how big of an impact that Katie McCabe has had and how big she is within Arsenal circles. Like, in the women's game, there are few names bigger in the WSL than Katie McCabe. Mm. Like, she is a bona fide superstar. She is probably, I always compare her sort of like to where Roy Keane was at Manchester United. Obviously, Roy Keane had more success over a prolonged period of time, but in terms of like how the Arsenal fans viewed her, her leadership on the pitch, the way that she played, she played very much on the edge, and that is unusual in the women's game. And she played like someone who has had to fight against her brothers growing up the entire time. She played on the edge.
I would have played against our brother Gary growing up throughout the years. But one of the words I would use with Katie, and I mean this as a positive and as an attribute, she's nasty. She can be really nasty at times. But I think if you're going to be an elite player, men's or women's football, you've got to have that little nasty streak. And Katie has that. And, you know, I love when she starts getting physical and really aggressive with other players. And like you say, there is the hint of Roy Keane. She demands better, but women's football is at a place now where they shouldn't be settling and say, okay, we're happy that people are starting to take notice. She's still driving it on and being, as we say, that trailblazer. So more power to Katie. And as I say, I really don't think this is anywhere near the end for her. I still think she's got, you know, 4 maybe 5 years left at the top. She's that good, so this is nowhere near the end. Plenty more to come.
Like, I think when she would have started at Arsenal, like, Arsenal weren't playing in, you know, the big stadium, and now they're playing next season, week in, week out, they'll be playing in the Emirates. So she's a big role to play in that. And that's not just Arsenal Football Club's women's history, that's just, you know, English football history right there. As you say, 10 years of service for Arsenal, and she's been one of their most consistent players over that time period. There's a reason they sing her name every weekend. There's not too many Irish footballers that have gone to England and, you know, have their name sung week in, week out in the Premier League. I hope she goes to a good standard of club still. I think she's still, like you said, she's only 30.
She still has the potential to play at the top level.
Yes, it's the top level and still playing a good level of Champions League football. I think she's a lot more to give in the club scene.
Very much part of the green wave as well with the Irish women's national team. And also, not that this matters all that much, but I think she was very important in bringing male viewers over to the women's national team as well, because she's such a good player that everyone wanted to tune in to see what sort of banger she was going to score.
Unbelievable left foot. And she incredible. Can play left back, left wing back, left wing. She can play as a holding midfielder. She can play as an attacking midfielder. That versatility is gold dust at the top level.
100%. On the back of, what do we got here? The Irish Daily Mail. So on the back of this, we've got Rory rages as PGA dream fades. One of my favourite quotes from Rory McIlroy of all time, potentially coming yesterday. He was asked, what went wrong or what happened? How would you describe that round? And he just replied, shit.
Fair enough.
Absolutely fair. He finished the back nine with bogey, birdie, and then 4 bogeys. Mm. So not ideal for him.
Sounds like one of my golf cards.
Yeah.
Erratic.
I'd be delighted with that.
It's a mad sport, isn't it? Like, it's just so up and down. Mm. There's no such thing, like, unless you're Scottie Scheffler, there's no such thing as, you know, pure consistency. It's just impossible to achieve in golf.
That's why Scottie Scheffler is world number one.
Yeah.
And Rory McIlroy is world number two, because Scottie Scheffler does have that consistency, and Rory McIlroy, look, he's playing for the majors now. That's what he's doing. Also on the back of the Daily Mail, we have, give us a fair go, Hearts concerned about officiating for Celtic showdown. So Derek McInnes is getting a word in early here that he wants the tomorrow's title decider at Celtic Park to be decided on the pitch by the players, not by the officials. So, Keith, we don't want to linger too long on the actual decision itself, because I think everybody and their mother has been chatting about this since it happened. But the reaction to this VAR decision in the Celtic game against Motherwell on Wednesday night, it has been incredible. Like, the whole football world are talking about this in such a way that you would think that it was the most egregious decision that anybody had ever seen.
Yeah, I'm hearing stuff from, it was a Gary Lineker tweeted that it's the worst ever VAR decision he's seen. It's nowhere near that. It really isn't. And people are thinking about the outcome rather than the standalone decision. The standalone decision, I can see if your heart or your mother, well, why you would be annoyed, because I was here on the night, I looked at it in real time. I actually thought it was given for an elbow, and then obviously it transpired it was given for handball. I've seen probably 30 replays of it now, and it looks like there's a little bit of hand, it looks like there's a bit of head, there's maybe a small bit of an elbow in there as well. I would concede that I would be absolutely raging if that was given against me. But there is a little element of, I can see why that's given as well. It's not like you're looking going, I can't see anything there. There is a little bit of something there, but to go for VAR's worst ever decision, I mean, the force, I've done my top three because I think the reaction to this is totally, totally just bonkers in terms of how bad some of the VAR decisions have been over the years. And for my third one, I've gone Everton against Liverpool back in 2020. Do you remember Jordan Pickford came out with the horror tackle on Virgil van Dijk, like a scissor tackle, knee height, nailed him, put him out for the rest of the season. And VAR thought, oh, he's a goalkeeper, it doesn't really matter, he can do what he likes. One of the worst decisions I've seen. You can't go around just, you know, karate chopping people at knee height and think it's going to be all right. The second one is another Liverpool game, but this was Tottenham against Spurs. Luis Diaz back in 2023 scored a goal, judged to be offside. Then VAR decided, oh, we'll have a closer look at that. And he realised, oh, he's onside, would you believe? Shocking VAR decision. But the worst one for me, and it's whenever people talk about bad VAR decision, this is the one that goes straight into my head. And it has huge ramifications in the Premier League. Aston Villa against Sheffield United in 2020. Oliver Norwood took a free kick on the left wing, overhit it. It looked like the ball had crossed the line. It wasn't Martinez. I can't remember the Villa goalkeeper, but it wasn't Emi Martinez. The ball goes over the line. It gets shuffled out. The Sheffield United players are convinced it crossed the line. It did. Hawkeye failed, the referee. VAR could have easily intervened and went, no, it did go over the line, but they didn't. Hawkeye fails, VAR fails, all these things that are, you know, they're so, you know, they're supposed to be right all the time, and they got failed twice. And I think Aston Villa actually ended up staying up by a point that year, which was absolutely huge. So
huge for them, yeah.
Unbelievable. Like, yeah. That for me is the worst ever VAR decision. Not only did Hawkeye fail, VAR failed after it, and the linesmen that are watching and the referee that's on the pitch, everybody failed that. But because it's Sheffield United, people go, yeah, don't worry about it. They were supposed to be relegated anyway. That for me is the worst ever VAR decision.
Edward Freeman says on YouTube that the standalone decision was a joke. Celtic fans say penalty. The rest of the world say not penalty. That decision could decide a league title. That's why it's so bad. Now, I do take issue with this point. This is the point that I can't stand behind. I understand that people don't want a refereeing decision and a VAR decision to decide the league. That side I can get behind. That's the point I made with the Arsenal decision as well, that we're in a world where VAR and referees are deciding titles.
Yeah.
That is an issue, and I really dislike that. But in terms of a decision being made in itself, it shouldn't matter what the consequence of the decision is. You still have to make it.
Mm.
So if that is a handball on the 27th minute in a mid-season game that has no consequences, it should still have the same level of scrutiny and decision making as a 97th minute VAR decision that decides the title. It's inconsequential what actually happens as a result of the decision in the referee's mind. It should all be an objective decision based on what's actually happening in the game, not on what's going to happen if I make this decision. The referee, it cannot be in the referee's mind that if he makes a call that it's going to decide a title. He should be making that call based on what is he seeing in front of himself.
I think it's okay for him to have that in his mind and feel the pressure of it, but he still has to make the right decision. It shouldn't come into the decision making. Obviously, exactly, he's human. Yeah. He's going to be like, oof, this is a big decision.
He's going to feel the pressure, but it shouldn't impact his decision.
Yeah, it should not impact the decision itself.
Don't referees weigh up the decision? Like, I've seen players that are on yellow cards and have like a silly little one where they kick the ball away, or it's a little altercation, and the referee will think in the back of his head, if I give him another yellow, he's off, and he doesn't quite deserve that, so I'll hang fire and think, well, you're going about what the repercussions are rather than the standalone defence. And I think referees do that an awful lot. But yeah, I take your point. When the ball comes in, the referee shouldn't be thinking, oh, if I give a penalty here, Celtic might win the league, and so on and so forth. But if it was the other way around, if Motherwell were given a penalty against Celtic, and it was the exact same scenario, I don't think anybody's too bothered. The fact that it's leaning into the narrative that the big boys are being favoured and it's Celtic's league to win, and the SPL all want the bigger boys to win it, they don't want Hearts to win, I think that's a load of old nonsense. But when you look at that, you can see why the Hearts fans and Motherwell fans and Rangers fans, everybody else is aggrieved. But I can see it. I can see there's a touch of handball in there, but like I say, I'd be fuming if it was given against me.
My favourite reaction to this has been people on TikTok or on video, out videoing themselves doing scientific experiments to see if they can head the ball the distance while also having their hand up. I should say as well, the Scottish handball rule is slightly different to the English rule as well. And I think that's causing a little bit of confusion for people who are casual viewers of the Scottish League and coming in from this cold. So there is actually a handball rule in place for his hand being where it is above his head in the handball rules, law 12 in the Scottish handbook, that the ball touches a player's hand or arm when it is above their shoulder, it is a free kick or a penalty. So if John Beaton, who's the referee on the night, thinks that it touches hand, his hand's above his head, so he doesn't really have much of a choice there.
Yeah, have a penalty. That's something that people haven't brought. What is his hand doing up there? I mean, we know we use our arms to get elevation in the jump, but not to the point where it's up that height.
It did look like, I know we're getting into the decision itself now, Trussie, the Celtic defender, did kind of nudge his arm up a little bit, and that's why his hand was up in the air. But like, I don't know how you police it. It's a tough decision, but like,
it is.
Looking at that still photo that's come out probably last night, yesterday evening, people started to send that around Twitter. It's hard not to agree with the decision that was made.
Loads of people saying that image was AI as well. I can confirm to you it is not. We have an Alami subscription and the image exists. It is real. Just before we move on, a reminder that Off the Ball Breakfast is with Viagra Connect. 50 milligram film-coated tablets contain sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage of 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation. I do want to move on to Michael Carrick. He's on the back page of The Sun here, saying that it's probably going to be him that's going to get the United job. But interestingly enough, the Manager of the Year nominations are out, Keith, and it's controversial to say the least. So we've got six managers have been nominated. We've got Keith Andrews, fair, I think. Did a great job with Brentford this year. Mikel Arteta, top of the league, probably going to win the league, fair. Pep Guardiola, you know, not the best season for Man City, but FA Cup final, still in the chance of winning the league.
You've got to take resources and everything else into account, haven't you? Like, it's
true, but you can make the argument, let's say.
Yeah,
it's not the most egregious one.
We can make the argument. Andoni Iraola.
Yep.
No-brainer. Fantastic job with Bournemouth. Yep. Reggie Labrie, first time up with Sunderland. One of the best teams to watch this year.
100%.
Obviously. And then Michael Carrick is nominated for the Manager of the Season as well. 15 games.
Shocking.
15 games.
Absolutely shocking. I just think it's lazy. I think it's really lazy. And look, I'm not trying to take away from Carrick. The 15 games he's played in the Premier League, he's won 10, only lost 2. It's been really good. Really, really good. But you can't join a marathon halfway through and think you're going to, you know, get the best time. It's just not going to happen. And it's not just that Carrick has been thrown into the mixer. It makes you think, oh, well, nobody else is really setting the world on fire out there. That's why Michael Carrick has been nominated. Unai Emery, fifth at the minute with Aston Villa, got the Europa League final to look forward to, could finish fourth in the Premier League. Unbelievable how he's been overlooked. Daniel Farke at Leeds, people, was it in around Christmas, people were saying he'll get sacked, and then he got another lease alive. Leeds stuck with him, never really flirted with relegation from then on. So he's had a brilliant season.
Also, he played a massive role in that as well, because he actually did something within management and changed his team.
That's it.
So he showed his
just reinvented it. But Fabian Hörtler at Brighton, seventh at the minute could finish sixth, and people go, oh, a sixth play finish with Brighton isn't that great, but they don't put, like, that's Brighton finishing top six, top seven, unbelievable achievement. David Moyes at Everton, Hill Dickinson Stadium, everybody knows when you go to a new stadium it can be very, very tricky. So to be finishing 10th and only just over the last 2 weeks coming off that European race, Everton, I think there's a lot of managers there that'll be looking at Michael Carrick thinking, are you for real? Like, where's the brain trust that put this one together? 15 games. Unbelievable. And don't get me wrong, his form has been great, but like, he's just not up there with Arteta, who's, as we say, could win the Champions League and Premier League, top of the league all season. Regis Labrice at Sunderland, talking about him getting sacked if they don't get Europe.
That's absolutely crazy to me.
Talk about the goalpost changing. Keep us up, Regis. Oh yeah, I've done that. Now get us into Europe, but you're sacked. There's in the same season.
The story behind that in Sunderland seems to be like almost they've a split backroom team in the Sunderland board at the minute, that people who know the league and know how good this is are saying to the people who want to sack him, that no, you can't move the goalposts this far. Just because we're doing really good doesn't mean that we should be doing this good. It's like, this. No, we are overachieving here.
Yeah,
is what they're saying.
I think, I think there's a conversation to be had about Iriola. He's been really good this season, but all in all, for me, I think you just give it to Keith Andrews. And there might be a bit of Irish bias here, but at the start of the season, I thought if Keith gets to Christmas, he'd have done well. Yeah. Now it looks like he's going to get to the end of the season. And with the players they've lost, I don't need to go through them all again. They lost a manager as well. His DNA was in the club. It just looked like an uphill battle. And coming in as the set-piece coach to, you know, first-team coach, huge, huge jump. But Keith has taken to like a duck to water and played some lovely football at Brentford. I know they get thrown into the long throw stuff and all that. They're a very, very difficult team to play against, but surely Keith Andrews is the one to win it.
I think he's had the most impressive season out of anyone. Someone making the point in the comments that Carrick might have been there because there was no other English manager in the running.
That's a fair point.
I'd go David Moyes before they went for Carrick.
Yeah, David Moyes is another one, yeah. Like, is I think six nominees is crazy as well, considering there's only 20 managers.
Oh, you think it's not enough?
I think it's way too much.
You think it's too many?
Yeah, like, what's the point?
It's probably six. Look, you can probably narrow it down to like Andrews, Arteta, and probably Iraola.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that, yeah.
Like, it because of Bournemouth's success over the last number of years, and by success I mean finishing in the top half of the table, you forget that they're not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
You know, they could be potentially playing Champions League football next year in a stadium that holds 13,000 people.
Yeah. And so let's not forget Bournemouth lost their best player. And like, I know they always lose their best player, but to lose Semenyo in January was a big, big hit.
And just to kept keep going. They decimated their defensive line as well.
At the start
of the season.
And money just, they've turned over from transfers. Zabarni, was it, went to PSG, and they had another centre half as well, but unbelievable. I actually think they'll do City next week after the FA Cup final, and it's just because of the whole feel of the game. You get, the City will play in front of 80,000 people against Chelsea on the weekend, and then they'll go to Bournemouth and there'll be 11,000 people there. It will feel flat. It will feel really, I know it's a big game for Bournemouth in terms of maybe still getting European football, but I think that high that Manchester City will be on, especially if they win the Cup, there's going to be an inevitable drop off. And if you drop off against a team like Bournemouth, they're very capable of haunting you.
For sure.
Dermot Keenan in touch there in the YouTube. Dermot, big fan of yours in the comments. I disagree with this point, though. Ah, lads, I know we love the fact an Irishman is doing so well, but Mikel Arteta has to win Manager of the Year as he's winning a first league title in over 20 years and possibly a Champions League. Look at the squad he has, Arteta. Come on. Like, Keith Andrews' squad was halved at the start of the season. And like, I'm not afraid to admit, at the start I was like, he's gone by Christmas. This is an impossible job that he's been given. And he's done absolutely brilliant with them. Turned over some massive teams. Got the best out of some players like Igor Thiago. Like, no one was talking about him as a guy who'd be, he's not in the running for the Golden Boot, but he's, you know, he's up there at the top three or four. I think he's done an immense job, and I don't think it's... There's obviously a little bit of Irish bias in this, especially on this show, because he was on the show quite regularly at one point. But I do think he's done a remarkable job. And there's a reason a lot of English journalists and pundits have been talking about him in this in this type of conversation, is because he's earned that right.
Well, I think out of everybody on that list, Keith Stock has risen the most. I think I know Michael Carrick going in, but he's managed before and had a decent reputation. Keith has come in as a set piece coach, and I think his stock, like, there'll be clubs now way ahead of Brentford that'll be having a little flair, thinking, could we take Keith in on the cheap and could he reinvent things here? But like, if you're looking at Arteta and thinking, well, his squad, and you know that there's minimal improvement there. And Pep Guardiola's got to be painted with the same brush, given the finances. I mean, he spent 80 million in January, two of the best players in the Premier League, and yet they might not win the Premier League. Was it the quarterfinals they got beaten in the Champions League against Real Madrid? I think it's been underwhelming stuff from Manchester City, although they're still very, very good when they do click. But in terms of, you know, winning domestic trophies, I think that's probably the bare minimum of Pep Guardiola. I don't think he'd be going into the big wigs and saying, look, I've had a brilliant season, haven't I? I'm not so sure.
They've been hit or miss all year. They've been, like, as good as Arsenal's season has been, they have left the door open a couple of times, and Man City haven't been able to capitalise to an extent where they've taken the lead in the Premier League and ran with it. I'd be surprised if Pep Guardiola's in the conversation. It's hard to look past Mikel Arteta for manager of the season as well, if they do win it. Like, if Keith Anders did a fantastic job, but he can't be too aggrieved either.
When Michael Carrick gets the letter into the training ground this morning saying you've been nominated for manager of the season, he probably thinks it's a wind-up. Like, I've been in for 15 games. I honestly can't get my head around it, and even I don't want to go back into the Bruno Fernandes stuff, but you can't start playing in January and start managing in January and think, I'll be up for all the awards here. Even if he's won 15 from 15, you're thinking, you've joined the party too late, mate. You just can't get involved in this.
Also, he didn't, you know, it's not his team. He didn't set it up. Exactly. You know, he changed it, but we'll move on.
Yeah.
We'll move on, because we also have loads of League of Ireland stuff to get into as well as an Irish game this weekend against Grenada in Murcia. That's on Saturday night. Earlier this week, David Wilson was chatting ahead of this game, and he was talking about Liam Scales at Celtic and why he is going to be such a vital part of this future success of the team. This was on the Green Scene podcast.
But Liam Scales is now well and truly in a title race in Scotland. Celtic are well and truly in this race, and Liam Scales, who I think, David, you pointed out on Sunday, was absolutely outstanding.
Liam Scales was someone I think all Celtic fans could admit to it was maybe castigated for a long time, as he was the player that came from the League of Ireland and he's not good enough, and he's shown that he's way more than good enough, and he's developed into maybe the best defender in Scotland. He's played 35 games this year. He started 32 of them. He doesn't have any goals, but he's got 3 assists as well from kind of set pieces. He got a really important one away to Aberdeen there recently. And the development of his career is an example to everybody who is in the League of Ireland or is wanting to kind of aspire to bigger and better things. He was brilliant again on Sunday, and he's very key to what Ireland will, you know, want to achieve over the next couple of years, because you don't have a lot of left-footed defenders. And yeah, he's been absolutely excellent, and I'm kind of delighted for him as well, because he's, you know, he's taken maybe the path less travelled, and he's kind of got right to the top as well at a huge club in Celtic. So I'm hoping he gets his flowers eventually.
That was the Green Scene on Off the Ball, and it is with Cadbury, # supporter and a half. Liam Scales didn't have a great second half, it must be said, against Motherwell, but he has been a very solid performer for Celtic throughout the season. Want to talk about another Irish player very shortly in Jack Moylan. He's in the back of all the pages today, but let's get into some League of Ireland stuff, Keith, because there's a huge slate of games this weekend. Dundalk, as I mentioned, are playing Shamrock Rovers. That's going to be live on Off the Ball this evening. Ben Symes on commentary for that game, along with Vinnie Perth, former Dundalk manager, Vinnie Perth. But we've also got some games that are very, very tasty. I want to start with Bohemians. Keith, if that's all right. They're playing against Drogheda tonight. We've got Waterford against Derry, St. Pat's against Shelburne, Dundalk against Shamrock Rovers, and Sligo Rovers against Galway. On Bows, so they beat Dundalk last week, but that was their first win in a 9-game run without a win. After starting the season so well, What do you think's gone wrong for Alan Reynolds here and Bowes?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think at the start of the season, I looked at Patrick Hickey going in a centre-half, and I know he's more than comfortable there, but I was expecting him to play a little bit higher up the pitch. But Hickey and Todd, at the early stages of the season, struck up a really good relationship. And even now, I think it's only 15 goals they conceded, which is not a bad return, but they just seem to be a little bit more leaky than they have been at the start. And with the likes of Tierney, Rooney, Whelan, Parsons as well, they've got a lot of firepower at the top end of the park. And Dawson Devoy, I mean, people are banging on at me, and I've made the case for Dawson to get into the Irish training camp. I went to watch him in Inchicore, Pats against Bowes, and he was largely anonymous, didn't do an awful lot in the game. And people, the Pats fans, were saying to me with their tongue firmly in their cheek, and, you know, why would he be getting into the Irish team and X, Y, and Z? And on his performance in Inchicore, I thought, yeah, I can understand why he's be given out. But Dawson just needs to find that consistency week in, week out. He's a very, very good player, but when he gets man-marked, or people think, I'm just here to stop you playing, he struggles a little bit. So I think there's improvements to be made all over the park, defensively, in the midfield, and up the top end. They could be a little bit more ruthless, given what they have there. But I think, you know, Alan Reynolds, it seems that he gets everybody on side, and they play really well, Bowes, but it feels like they're only a 10-minute spell away from everybody saying, we want him out again, and he's just constantly up against it. Well, yeah, a lot of improvements to be made from a Bowers point of view. And Drogheda are no easy team. Probably not a team you want to play against when you're not quite sure of yourself.
Yeah, at the start of the season, when they started so well and they're top of the table, the one thing that a lot of Bowers fans, if you speak to them, were saying, they're like, they're in great shape. Mm. They look really fit. They're firing. They look fast. Is there a chance here that, like, maybe Bowers prep is really good for the start of the season, but then everyone catches up with them, and then suddenly that added edge of being the fittest team in the first 3-4 weeks is eliminated after the first 3 or 4 weeks because everyone's up to scratch, and suddenly you just reverse to the mean a little bit here? Because I mean, Bowes are still third.
Yeah,
I know Bohemians fans will say that they should be fighting for the title, but really, if you look at the squads, Shamrock Rovers are the strongest squad. They're top of the table. St. Pat's are the second strongest squad. Maybe Derry could make an argument for that. They've obviously underperformed massively this season so far, but like Bowes in third, that's sort of where you would expect if you look through the squads.
Yeah, I think it's more that they're 9 points off Shamrock Rovers already, and the fact that we look at Rovers and think they're notoriously slow starters, they've already got a 3-point lead over St. Pat's, they've got a 9-point lead over Bowes. But when I look at Bowes, I looked at them at the start of the season. They played Shamrock Rovers and Daly Mount, and they just ran all over Shamrock Rovers. They got the Daly Mount crowd involved. And for all the lovely footballers they have, and talking about Dawson Devoy in the middle of the park, and they've got one or two others that can get involved in there, with the success they had early doors, I think they started to believe that we're a really good footballing team here. Mm. We can start doing all this, get the ball to Dawson, get it out wide, come in through the middle, all this, these nice little triggers and phrases that we like to use. But I think, as you said, and the Bowes' main weapon is their fitness. So just run all over teams and harass them, get them into making mistakes and stuff like that. And then when you do that, the game will calm down, and then you can play a little bit football. Possibly guilty of trying to play a little bit too much football at times, but look, I think each unit defensively, midfield and at the top, there's improvements to be made all over the park. But I think that word consistency that I use with Bowes is probably a word that I'd use for, you know, the other 9 clubs within the League of Ireland that aren't Shamrock Rovers.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Dawson Devoy and the Ireland squad and talk of that, because he actually broke through Bohemians around the same time as Jack Moylan did. Mm. And Moylan actually name checks Dawson Devoy across the papers. He's speaking to the Irish press today ahead of the game in Grenada. It looks like he's going to make his debut for Ireland after taking the road less travelled. The headline is that Damien didn't mollycoddle me. And that's actually, it's a play on words more than anything, because Damien Duff used to text him to say, one of the first things he said was, I need to stop eating my ma's coddle. And Moylan found this funny because he doesn't eat coddle and his mom's a vegetarian.
which is great. That's great Brilliant. Stuff. But Jack Moylan, as I said, road less travelled. He speaks story, about yeah. going to England. He said he just wasn't good enough himself to be there. He wasn't strong enough, wasn't fast enough. At that time of his career, comes back, struggles with Bowes, ends up signing with Wexford, then goes to Shelburne under Damien Duff. Obviously has a fantastic season, scores 22 goals for Shelburne across his across that season, and now he's with Lincoln City in League One. He scored 11 goals this season.
Yeah.
So he's sort of making that step up. He said the biggest step up from Ireland to England has been one of his first games was against Stevenage, and he said everyone just felt like they were like 6'6".
Mm.
And monsters, and he's not small himself. He's 6'1". So if he's feeling small yeah. on the pitch, then yeah. you know he's not lying. What are your thoughts on Jack Moylan and his rise and what kind of player he's going to be for Ireland?
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Again, he's somebody that I look at and think, you know what, is there something there? Could he go on to? I know he's going to be in the Championship next season. He's 24 years of age. There's every chance he could get into the, and I mean, when I say the Irish team, I don't mean this Irish team over the friendlies. I mean the proper Irish team when the big games come around. And why not? And I think it's brilliant the stuff that, you know, Damien Duff did and mollycoddle me. I know Duffer can be a hard taskmaster, but what I like about Duffer, it's black and white. He sets out the bar, and this is what you need to get to. These are the standards I'm setting. Either you get to them or you move on. It's as simple as that. We won't fall out about it. And it looks like Jack at the time thought, well, this is an Irish legend who's won everything he can win, telling me the standards I need to reach. And it's looked like he's reacted really well to that. And the fact that he's gone to Lincoln, Lincoln, I played a couple of games against Lincoln back in the day in pre-season games and, you know, FA Cup games and stuff like that. Really, really tough place to go and get a win. And the fact that the Lincoln fans have taken to Jack, I mean, why wouldn't they with his 11 goals and 6 assists this season? And we're all desperate for that number 10 to be able to play a bit. And maybe Jack is somebody who wasn't really on my radar as coming in as Ireland's number 10. He's definitely on the radar now. And I always think, you know, these games against Grenada and training camps and stuff, you sort of look at them and roll your eyes and think, who wants to be involved in that as a professional footballer? And I make no apologies in telling the story again because I think it's very prudent. I played for an Ireland B team under Trapattoni against Nottingham Forest in Dalymount. Keith Andrews and Wes Houlihan played in the game as well, and they got took off at half time and they were in the next senior squad. I think they were playing Cyprus in Crow Park for the 2010 World Cup qualifiers. And you look, when we turned up to play against Nottingham Forest's B team as an Ireland B team, you're thinking we're a million miles away from that Ireland team. We're never going to get anywhere near it. But Keith played really well. Wes played really well. I didn't get into the Irish team, I think, for another 18 months, so I clearly didn't play that well. But just when you're thinking, this is just a pat on the back, I'm only here because the big hitters aren't here, there's always a chance again in the back door. Always, always a chance. And if Jack impresses, you know, he could propel himself to, I wouldn't say proper Irish international, because he is a proper Irish international if he becomes one over the next friendly game. But to put some, you know, qualifiers and real big, meaningful Irish games on your CV is what Jack will want to do, and he's very, very capable of it.
Yeah, Jack actually says in the piece that he doesn't want this to be, oh, I get called in and isn't it great for this friendly game? I want to be part of the Irish squad going forward. But let's see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be nice to see a few new faces playing for Ireland as well. I think there's half of the 20-man squad is new to the team and could be making their debut.
So. I wouldn't generally be into, you know, just giving out Ireland caps like their Skittles. I'd like to have a bar, but very rare you get friendlies and stuff like that in international football now, so blood as many of them as you like.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, Rory Finneran coming into the team and Will Ferry as well coming in from Scotland. There probably could have been another couple of players playing in Scotland called in if they weren't playing in the actual important parts. You know, you're probably looking at McEntee at Hearts. If he wasn't in a title race, he'd be into the Ireland squad. Probably will be,
I'd say, at some point. He's had a cool story himself as well. It adds a bit of meaning to this game as well, because people will look at this game. It's only on the RT player and the news channel, I think, and it's Grenada. I don't think it's not a great sell, but the fact that they're not just putting out a team that would be similar to what you'd have full strength means it, in a weird way, it's actually kind of a meaningful game, as you say, to blood players in. So yeah. I think that will draw a few eyes on it.